is Sierra Dahl with the Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to be talking about energy storage. We have four people on the panel, and some interesting conversations about some new energy technology and an interesting project on reusing energy batteries. If everybody who is online who is not actually speaking right now would please mute themselves so that we don't hear background noise, which I'm hearing right at the moment. But our first presenter is going to be Roger Wilkins. And are you going by Upgrade Athens County, Roger, or have you changed that to something else? I can't remember.
Well, that organization is in transition, but this is actually a project that is being done by a nonprofit that I head, the Center for the Creation of Cooperation, and we're doing it in collaboration with a renewable energy co-op in this area. So it's a collaborative project.
Roger's over there in Ohio, so yeah, just so everybody knows where you're from. Go ahead, Roger.
Okay, yes, I'm in the southeast corner of Ohio, a semi-rural area, and we've worked on a variety of projects bringing community choice aggregation and energy efficiency programs, and gradually we discovered that there are already a flood of lithium-ion batteries that are being discarded with a substantial amount of power left in them. Hello. And it's projected that coming out of electric vehicles, there's going to be literally a tsunami of lithium-ion batteries coming out with as much as 80% of their power still left in them, but not meeting the stringent requirements for electric vehicles. So both because of the rare minerals, the lithium and cobalt in these, as well as the power left in them and the investment left in them, there is already a great and rapidly growing opportunity for disassembling, testing, and reassembling these second life batteries into new battery packs, typically in stationary applications where we can get a great deal more power out of them. And we're looking at it as an opportunity to create local employment through a network of worker co-ops in our rural area and reaching well, up into Michigan and down into Appalachia below us, and really see a multifaceted opportunity here centered around Second Life batteries. So that's my intro.
Okay. That certainly is an interesting project. Rick Brown from Terra Verde Renewable Partners out in California, do you want to talk a little bit about what went on out?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm sorry for the background noise. I am driving my new Tesla Model 3, which I'm really excited about.
I guess so. Wow.
On my auto steer. So sorry for the background noise. I'll be landing shortly. But Terra Verde Energy is a company based in California. We serve mostly municipal and nonprofit organizations, although we're doing a little bit of work in the private sector. But we work with schools, cities, water agencies, transit agencies on helping them figure out the feasibility of implementing a variety of different clean energy technologies, most recently battery storage, mostly paired with solar, but sometimes on a standalone basis, and mostly for the purpose of offsetting or shaving demand charges, which are growing much more rapidly here in California than generation charges. So the economics are pretty strong. But once, of course, the batteries are installed, we're also involved working with community choice agencies and other load-serving entities, including the Bay Area Rapid Transit District and the High Speed Rail Authority, on figuring out how they can use the batteries to serve other needs. And we have a project right now that would, in addition to the demand savings approach or value, aggregating those batteries across multiple jurisdictions and even residential batteries into what's called a virtual power plant, where that battery capacity can be used and sold into emerging markets here in California, capacity markets for a variety of different needs, including voltage regulation and so forth, in some cases resource adequacy. And so we've got a couple of R&D projects, one through the National Renewable Energy Lab, one through the California Energy Commission, to develop tools that will allow load-serving entities, community choice agencies, to figure out where and how they can best locate distributed energy resources, most importantly, stationary battery storage, to serve those needs. So that's kind of a thumbnail of what we're involved in right now.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Lori Schell is Empowered Energy, and Lori is operational out of Durango, Colorado, but Lori, you kind of work all over the place, too. So why don't you tell us what's going on? You've got some interesting technologies there.
Thank you, Sierra. I'm happy to have been invited to join the group. Lots of interesting discussions already. So I mainly work – I'm an economist, an energy economist, so look at the interactions between the different markets for renewables, natural gas, power, emissions, and also I'm a numbers guy, so I do a lot of number crunching, economic analysis, value propositions of emerging energy technologies. And a lot of the work that I do is with the Advanced Power and Energy Program out of the University of California at Irvine, kind of their non-in-house economist. So the CRA asked me to talk today. We are working on grid-scale energy storage that doesn't involve traditional batteries, and it's really associated with the increase in curtailed renewable generation as the renewable energy standards continue to rise and get more and more curtailment. So we have done significant amount of work looking at the use of electrolyzers as the first step to split water, taking otherwise curtailed renewable energy, split the water, save the hydrogen as both an energy carrier and as a means of energy storage. And because the hydrogen can be, you know, can be stored on site or can be put into a number of different use pathways, we've looked at the kind of economics of a number of different use pathways, including, for instance, injecting the hydrogen directly into the natural gas pipeline system, which, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how much, what concentration of hydrogen you can actually put into the pipeline system before you get embrittlement. In Europe, they're thinking perhaps up to 20%. UC Irvine campus has done up to 4% and not seen any impact on either the piping or their turbine. The other option would be to methanate the hydrogen, and then you can inject it into the natural gas pipeline system up to whatever the capacity of the pipeline system is. Another pathway is to use it as fuel directly into fuel cell vehicles, or to use it as fuel going into fuel cells, and then you can put the power back onto the grid during periods of high demand. So we've got the, how we say, power to gas, if you're creating the hydrogen or the methane, or power to gas to power if you are using it as fuel for a fuel cell and then returning it back to the electric grid.
I imagine that'll generate some questions. Thanks, Lori. Robert Kaplan, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Okay. My name is Rob Kaplan. My company is Green Resources. We're doing everything from DER technologies, some new DER technologies that we'd like to bring forward. I mean, to what the panel's already discussed, I would like to discuss some of the technologies that I'll work with in the future, not on this conversation. One of the technologies we're working with right now is called lead crystal batteries. I'm actually an agent for it in the U.S. They're actually bringing it to Mexico. It's been used around the world for a number of years already, particularly in Europe right now. They're taking British Telecom is actually using it to replace the lithium-ion batteries on their telecommunication towers. And part of the reason is from a value proposition point of view, as Laurie pointed out, it makes a lot of sense for lithium ion. I like to come forward, like to look at things from a value proposition point of view. Now, I'm not saying lithium ion is a bad way to go, but sometimes when you look at it from a value proposition point of view, from a cost analysis, and also from a generation capacity and a longevity capacity, there's a lot of different technologies, from flow batteries out there to other technologies that have different ways of producing energy and can actually be more productive in a sense, in some ways. As everybody probably knows, flow batteries are more of a energy storage system than a power generation system, where that's where lithium ion comes into play. So, you know, what I'd like to say is, hey, there's lots of new technologies coming online still. So the battery technology business is still in its infancy and still coming forward in a big way. So we're working on anything from small-scale systems to residential systems to municipal and industrial projects, even utility-scale projects. So I hope that we can all have something to contribute here and see what we can discuss and share with each other that makes a lot of sense. So that's my little spiel.
All right. Thank you. All of you are working on such interesting projects for sure. I'm going to mute everybody. Somebody has their line open. We're getting a lot of background noise, and I don't know who it is. So I'm going to mute everybody except for the presenters and let them have some time to talk here. So
conference muted.
And then I'm going to unmute the panel, and then we'll open it up to everybody in just a little while here. So hang on. Let me do that. Okay. So panelists, why don't you go ahead, and if you have questions for each other, please feel free, and we'll, a few minutes after you're done kind of talking among yourselves, we'll go ahead and open it up to other people for questions. Anybody?
Yep, well, Robert, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Laurie.
Can Robert give us just a little bit more on the lead crystal batteries? That's not
sure.
A technology that I'm familiar with.
First of all, most people are familiar with AGM batteries and the history behind AGM and lead acid batteries. The one big difference in lead crystal batteries actually started in the 1960s by the U.S. military, but they were never able to bring it to the production that they wanted to. So in 2003, I think it was, another company overseas in Europe took the ball and ran with it, and they produced it where they can produce 12 volts consistently. We've actually had it tested by an independent source, not of our own doing, not even of our own volition. And they tested it and got 11,400 cycles on it on the lead crystal batteries. And anybody who's familiar with lithium ion, for instance, knows that most lithium ion will say, we're going to give you 5,000 cycles or a 10-year warranty. In this case, we're going to get a lot more cycles out of it, and therefore the duration is going to be a lot longer. Cost-wise, it's basically going to come in somewhere between an AGM cost and a lithium ion. One big factor that we're looking at is the safety factor, because it basically is a solid state battery. Unlike AGM or anything else, we can actually put it on an airplane. There's no safety issues. We're trying to bring it into commercial buildings. We're looking in projects in New York where we'll actually put it inside of commercial buildings. And I think that will be a game changer, not only in New York City or in the New York metropolitan area, but nationally, even globally, only because of what it's going to produce, the amount of energy we can put out, but also the safety factor and also the recycling factor. And as everyone knows, as the first gentleman mentioned, they're looking to recycle lithium ion in a way that has a positive impact in Ohio. So I think we can have a very productive system of in a way of a value proposition.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else? Somebody else started out with a question. Go ahead.
This is Rick. I'm curious, Lori, to what, you know, one of the things that's concerning us out here in California is some research that the Department of Environment at City of San Francisco has done on leakage rates on natural gas, around natural gas. Mm-hmm. And they're coming up with, you know, from well to you know, home, leakage rates that are much higher than what the industry has traditionally, you know, stipulated. Mm-hmm. And at the, some of the rates that they're seeing, so even the notion of gas, natural gas as a, you know, of any form as a bridge fuel is really coming into question from a, you know, greenhouse gas standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering to what extent you all are looking at leakage rates in the use of hydrogen or, you know, the and also particularly around the methanization of hydrogen, because I'm really concerned that that's not a direction that's going to support some of the kinds of, you know, climate change purposes that many of us got into clean energy around.
Right, right. Thank you. So we, there is a grad student within the Advanced Power and Energy Program whose dissertation is specifically on methane leakage in the entire, you know, across the entire natural gas system, and she is, you know, visiting compressor stations, and that's a little bit early on in her research, so I can't tell you what her results are yet. So. But it's a you know, clearly a concern given the, you know, kind of toxicity of methane as a you know, as a greenhouse gas. I heard an interesting, I don't know if anybody else heard this. I think it was an industry webinar, but they were saying kind of done this whole idea of, you know, is the leakage such from the gas system such that, you know, it's really no better than coal. And their numbers, and I'm just saying this because I found it interesting, they said that you would have to have leakage rates up to 8% to, you know, to make it as bad as coal, which is not, I mean, that's not a very, you know, that's not a very good comparison that you want to make. But I thought that was interesting because most of the numbers that I've heard cited are, you know, 2.5% to maybe 4.5%. So just as a point of reference, and that, and you may know more about that than I do. It had to do with, I guess methane is more toxic than CO2, but it's shorter lived, and so it's kind of dependent on what range you, you know, what time period you looked at it. But I thought it was interesting.
If your student is interested, I'd be glad to send her the contact at the City of San Francisco. Their study is looking at, you know, that upper range. They're seeing,
okay,
you know, 6 to 12%.
Wow.
Actually, so yeah, it's.
I would be interested.
A little disturbing.
Yes,
in
seeing that report. Thank you.
Yeah. So
please, Sarah, go ahead. When you send anything, just send it to me, and I will make sure the whole entire group gets it, because there's a lot of people that can't make these conference calls that are very interested in the topic. So yeah, that'd be great. Thanks.
Okay.
Anybody else?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask Lori something. Lori, you were talking about hydrogen as far as using methane lines and trying to push hydrogen to let methane lines. I mean, one thing that I've looked at, and a lot of the car manufacturers have already been looking at for a long time, is hydrogen as a fuel cell for electric vehicles, including trucks. Have you looked in that direction in the sense of, and granted, the hydrogen infrastructure is not there at this point, but is that something that Empower has looked at from the point of infrastructure and how to go about producing an infrastructure like that, you know, for vehicles and for stationary?
Yes. So actually there is, you know, the California Energy Commission has put, I'm not going to give the number, but, you know, they, and actually based on work also done at the University of California, Irvine, have I believe there are 60 sites across the state that have been identified for hydrogen refueling that they believe is the kind of critical mass to, you know, kind of the chicken and the egg. So that, and that was based on work done at Irvine, and then First Element Fuel was based, as a couple of the founders of that, I was involved in a hydrogen fueling economic analysis that, you know, kind of inspired them to say, hey, this is the wave of the future. So the infrastructure, at least in California, you know, is on its way. With respect to heavy-duty vehicles, the same program, I'm actually working with UCI on a heavy-duty vehicle project that is funded by the Air Resources Board, because transportation is kind of the last bastion of, you know, of their major pollution efforts. So we're looking at, you know, all different types of alternate fuels in heavy-duty vehicles, including, you know, including fuels. Including fuel cells, because the National Fuel Cell Research Center is also cited. Actually, the same guy, Professor Samuelson, heads up both the Advanced Power and Energy Program and the National Fuel Cell Research Center. So there's a lot going on at UCI, kind of trying to look at all of these different facets.
Okay. Can I ask a question of the panel? How does everybody feel that, like, electric vehicles are going to affect the grid and our usage of electricity? I mean, my personal feeling is that, yes, it's a great thing. They're going to do it in a big way in Europe. But we have to take in the responsibility for what's going to amount of a large uptick in electric usage. And can the grid handle that if electric vehicles come on in a big way? So, I mean, anybody can grab into that. And I know, I guess Rick was talking about that already in a sense. But you guys can all contribute to that question.
Yeah, let me follow up. Yeah, no, we certainly, you know, we have some very aggressive policy goals here in California for the uptake of electric vehicles and particularly around electrification of bus transportation. Most public agencies, be they school bus transportation or public bus transportation, are expected to get to 50% electrification by 2025. So, you know, it is going to have a significant impact on demand and particularly since most people seem to like to charge when the bus runs end in the early evening for schools and most cases for public transit or when they come home from work. And that is, you know, going to put a particular stress in California, where our peak period is now shifting from the afternoon period to the evening ramp, the 4 to 9 period, because of the huge growth in solar production during the afternoon. And so there are a number of different, you know, policy initiatives out of California Public Utility Commission, the Cal ISO, the, you know, independent system operator, are, you know, going forward around in terms of how do we shape and you know, the way in which charging gets done to not overstress the grid. One interesting example, people mentioned community choice aggregation. I happen to live in what's known as Sonoma Clean Power Territory. And they have a program where they will give you a free level 2 charger that is, you know, internet connected, such that they can, you agree to let them manage your charging in order to help them manage, those kinds of issues, those load shaping issues. So we're going to see more and more of those kinds of programs coming out and being tested. And like I said, we're doing a project that will provide some analytics for load-serving entities around some of these kinds of issues to figure out how to best manage that. And there are also private companies that are coming out with software solutions for example, bus fleets to figure out how to manage their charging timing to levelize their loads and not put such a great impact on the grid.
Yeah, Rick, don't you think and this is, I guess, for the whole group, but it strikes me that, I mean, it's the controls are really the, you know, we used to say storage was the holy grail, but it strikes me now for if we want to get to 100% renewables, it's really all about the controls. You know, smart charging.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I don't know how many PhD dissertations were written early on about why you don't want to charge in the middle of the day during the peak. And now in California,
right.
I mean, you should probably be giving away that energy to have everybody charging on the solar peak.
Well,
exactly. I have my Tesla program to do that as we speak. So
to that point,
Roger,
I mean,
one second here. Roger, did you have something
sure.
to contribute to this?
Well, I do, and I think that storage, particularly in our area of the country, is really key, and of course, controlling that. But that ties into the value propositions that people were mentioning. That part of what we're looking at is the absolute market dominance of lithium-ion batteries, and while we really support new technologies, we have to face the fact that for the time being, in both EVs and non-EVs, lithium ions are the key batteries. And so we need to get full life out of those. And if they're being discarded with 70 or 80% of their life still in them, then that radically shifts the value proposition. So we look at using second life batteries to really build a storage infrastructure that is viable and economic as key to not overloading the grid. And if we have adequate storage, then with, as it's been said, good controls, we can meet that increased demand and ramp up as the demand ramps up. But really, fully utilizing resources is absolutely key.
Roger, what percentage of production do you think recycling along the lines of what you're doing at scale, what percentage of kind of new lithium-ion production do you think that could displace?
Well,
a pie-in-the-sky question is just intriguing.
Yeah, I don't think it's seriously going to displace. I think that with the growth in particularly electric vehicles, but in other areas like power tools and medical equipment and every kind of portable computer and things, that the new demand is going to increase very dramatically. And I don't think by second life use we're going to diminish that, but rather radically change the value proposition. And I think particularly with electric vehicles, the cost of batteries are a very significant proportion. And if they're only being used to 70 or 80%, then that inflates the value. And provides a blockage to widespread adoption. So I don't think it's an either new or used. It's fully utilizing resources.
Because the growth of EVs will require new production, and you are using yours, you said, mostly for stationary uses.
Yes.
Yes, okay, great.
Can I ask, I mean, to Roger's point, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with what he has to say. And right now, lithium-ion is a choice of storage for EVs and, you know, vehicles of that sort, probably because of the weight restrictions or non-weight or in that respect. And it's going to give you a jump where you need it. I know I've looked at other technologies, for instance, lithium sulfur, that they've been working on for decades. And it's not here yet still, but they're claiming that it's going to be much lighter than lithium ion, any kind of lithium ion, and also give you a lot more juice, a lot more power than lithium ion as we know today. And one thing that I see, and this has nothing to do with this, even afterlife, what do you do with the lithium-ion battery? Because it isn't a disposable item that we can bring to a landfill or have any way of recycling. And I've heard not within the last year or so that China, for instance, has a stockpile of lithium ion that they don't know what to do with it because they cannot bury it in the ground. You can't burn it. You can't bury it. What do you do with that from that point of view?
Well, this is Roger again. I have not had the opportunity to track it down, but I have seen references to a couple of companies that are working on innovative technologies that do allow us to fully disassemble and recycle the materials in lithium-ion batteries. And so we want to dovetail our project with those kinds of companies and really foster that, because I don't think it makes any sense to be putting those materials back in the ground. We need to utilize them. And I think we're going to have similar questions about second life use of batteries as the technologies evolve, that we may shift to lithium iron phosphate or lithium sulfur or others, but they will still have questions about some second
disposal.
Life use. Yes, yep. And disposal. So we really need to evolve our concept and our system for dealing with the full life of these materials, these batteries, and the materials in them.
Mm-hmm. And recognizing the full costs of that disposal.
Can I make a statement?
This is Rick.
Go ahead.
I'd like to make a quick comment on this. And again, this is a really important issue because to extent my perspective, the urgency around climate change is why I got into this stuff. And that urgency has gotten greater over the years in my mind. And I heard arguments around, you know, the classic, you know, poly or silicon panels 10 years ago. Well, there's going to be new technologies. They're going to be better. They're going to be cheaper. They're going to be easier. If we had stopped and waited for new technology, we would not have been able to get the cost of solar down to the point where it's now basically, you know, competing and beating other more dirty fuels. I'm not saying we should stop doing research on battery technology, but we need to scale battery storage as quickly as possible. And anything that gets in the way of that, I think, is short-sighted. So we need to work on economy of scale, manufacturing, to get the pricing down so that we can deploy it as quickly as possible so we can uptake and deploy the clean energy from wind and solar that we now have the ability to do to replace and shut down coal and other fossil sources. And anything that sort of is put out there as a reason not to advance that, I think is problematic.
Okay.
Can I make a comment to Rick's comment?
One second here. I want to let the other audience members participate in this as well right now. So anybody else, I'm sure there's people out there that have questions and comments. It's an interesting group all the way around. So please, anybody else that has anything to contribute to this, go ahead and dive in one at a time and just ask what you need to ask.
Hi, this is Tom Stanton. Thank you very much for the discussion so far. Someone from, I think, Ohio mentioned the idea that there is a renewable energy co-op near Athens, and if you could send information about that organization. I know some folks here in mid-Michigan are trying to start various kinds of renewable energy co-ops, and we might very much benefit from having contact with the group in Ohio. I'm doing work related to this topic for the as-yet-undeveloped world and for the world like in California, where we've already got a utility grid that's spread far and wide, but new technologies using batteries make a great deal of sense at every scale you can think of, all the way down to your portable hand calculator or your wristwatch, and all the way up to very large Department of Defense facilities or college campuses with tens of megawatts of microgrid service. There's a massive revolution coming in this area, and I think the discussion today is important to have, and it's great to see these ideas moving forward in bits and pieces. I'll try to send some more reference material to Sierra that she can distribute to.
All right. One comment here. This is Sierra. Please, whoever is not muted, please mute your phones because we are getting some background noise, and I see that a couple are not muted right now. All right. That looks better. I can see it online. They let me know if people's phones are muted or not. So one other question I have is there's an 805-770-8118 number that doesn't have a name to it. Can you identify yourself?
The mystery person is Craig Lewis, Sierra.
I kind of thought as much, Craig. You kind of hide there in the bushes. I can't always tell your name.
I'm trying to remember
one of your multiple phone numbers.
Since you opened up my channel, you forced me to identify myself, I'll go ahead and just make a comment, which is that I found the conversation very interesting and in particular, you know, really resonate with the comments that Rick has made, and would just emphasize that we are truly in the early days of all of these technologies, even solar, which has been around now in pretty full form for 10 years, or maybe even a little more than that. It's early days, right? We're talking about the energy form of the future, which is going to go on for, well, probably as long as the world lasts, which hopefully will be a lot longer than Donald Trump's reign.
Let's not mention that name here.
Yeah, I know. It's like a
don't even get started on that topic.
Really.
Yeah. But y'all know what I mean. And electric vehicles are even younger. And when you start to see things like the Model 3, which probably sells in fewer than half the states right now, has already almost hit the top five selling passenger vehicle. Right, it is early days, and it's already getting to the top of the passenger vehicle sales list. So we are in for some very big changes and a huge upgrade to our energy system and transportation system. And the I just want to reemphasize what I heard Rick say with respect to we need to be going full board with these new technologies and. Yes, there will be lots of innovations along the way and people who, spread fear, uncertainty, and doubt about new technologies are usually people who have a real vested interest in keeping the status quo. So always look at them with suspicion. That's my comment. And I did also really appreciate the comment, I'm not sure who made it, about the fact that the real game here is in the control systems and, what the Clean Coalition refers to as the monitoring communication control, or MC squared, playing off of Einstein's famous formula for energy. monitoring control solutions are really, what's going to coordinate all of these renewable energy and energy storage demand response solutions. And electric vehicles are about as easy about as flexible a load as you get out there. So from a demand response play, electric vehicles are, almost a perfect solution.
All right. Any other comments on this, particularly from people we haven't heard from yet?
Hi,
yeah,
Sierra.
This is the
woman, let's her have her talk. Go ahead.
This is Karen Egerman. And I'd just like to make a comment about the recycling aspect of all this. I think it is important that we just go forward with finding the solutions to replacing fossil fuel. And I'm really very impressed that people are looking so closely at the recycling, because as human beings, we have a tendency to go whole hog for something without thinking about what the consequences further down the line are. And I'd like us not to put ourselves in a position where we have another huge problem to repair as we go forward. So I just would like to make that comment. That's all.
Can I make a comment to that? This is Rob Kaplan. What the young lady just said, I actually work with fly ash as well, which is a byproduct of carbon plants. And it's a problem on a scale that nobody really knows about. It's on the scale that is in the multiple billions of dollars. It's a problem that all the utilities throughout the nation, throughout the world, have because of all the carbon buildup that's been left behind, all the fly ash has been left behind. They've built, like the TVA had the big problem at Oak Ridge a number of years back, if everybody remembers, where a number of people died, and they're still cleaning that site up. And to that point, and that's why when I said about lithium ion before, when we start thinking about, oh, we're just going to get rid of it, and oh, down the line we'll just bury it in the ground or whatever, and we haven't looked at the end results and said, well, how do we get rid of this? Instead of saying, and someone once said, and I asked it purposely, well, how do we get rid of lithium ion? And he said to me, well, we'll create a new industry. Well, as we all know, we can create new industries, but sometimes the end results aren't what we expect. And I think it's better to get an answer before we go forward and say, oh, well, when we get there, we'll worry about the problem. And that becomes a bigger problem. So, I mean, I'm not against lithium ion. I just think that we should have solutions before just going forward and saying, well, we're going to put lithium ion out there, and that's because of the market and because of Elon Musk and other things that we've been using, you know, lithium ion for decades. It's not new. It's been the military's been using it for decades, along with other groups. And when you look at it from that point of view, we really need to find a solution to the problem before it becomes a bigger problem in the end. So, anyway.
Any comments on anything new that's going on in different areas related to batteries? Go ahead. Go ahead, whoever that was. Go ahead.
Yes,
Michael. Paul, have something going on.
Sarah, this is David Kay. Can I ask a question instead?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead. Sure.
Sure. I wonder if the people who are paying particular attention to the value proposition idea could talk about the technologies they've discussed and break down in a little more detail what the, you know, what are the economic breakthroughs that need to happen, and whether they're really related to better technology or market structures, scaling up, and economies of scale. I mean, what is it that needs to happen to get these technologies more widely adopted, the different ones that people have talked about?
Lori, do you want to take that
Rick.
One starting out? Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so in California, I mean, obviously it depends on, in terms of demand savings that batteries can provide, it obviously depends on both the rate structures and rates that exist, as well as for a particular, you know, usage, as well as the demand profile, and then on the underlying cost of the battery. As battery prices have continued to come down, you know, at least in California, increasingly commercial customers, you know, to a large part, are seeing, you know, real economic benefits, you know, such that, you know, either you see paybacks within, you know, 4 to 5 years with positive cash flows, you know, from the beginning on, you know, standard batteries that are in the, 120 to 240 kWh level right now. I mean, that exists. Now, where we need to see market changes is around the use of these batteries, you know, multi-use of these batteries for these other services when they're not being used for demand charge saving. And while there are pilots that are going on in California, we don't have a true robust market as of yet, something that one of the listeners here, Clean Coalition, Craig, is working on, we're working on, various advocacy and industry groups are working on. The third area, which is the one that to me just drives me the craziest, is that right now California doesn't allow you, a behind-the-meter customer, to discharge batteries beyond, in other words, to do export beyond the load that they have historically had. So we have this problem in California of needing energy in the 4 to 9 period, but if a particular customer has not had historical load during that period, they're not allowed to, you know, discharge a battery that's been charged with their solar plant in the afternoon to offset anything above their load. They can't do net export, which is really crazy. But we're working on trying to change that. But so there's policy issues, there's economic issues, and there's obviously customer load profile and rate structure issues.
Lori, did you want to weigh in on that question that was asked before?
Well, I would say ditto to everything that Rick just said. In my mind, the technologies are changing so quickly that the regulators, I don't think, can keep up. And so we have this, kind of perverse incentives or, lack of incentives that for, that Rick was just talking about, exporting battery energy storage from behind the meter, that are kind of thwarting the uptake of new technologies. For the hydrogen, side of things, and we touched on that, it's infrastructure. It's kind of that whole chicken and egg thing. And hydrogen specifically, it's for fueling stations, that's one thing. But if you're going to store hydrogen on to enable grid-scale use of these electrolyzer pathways, the cost of, above-ground hydrogen storage is at about $1,000 a kilogram, which is, it's gonna be a problem. So if underground storage is another option. You have the problem that hydrogen is such a small molecule. And then I think for fuel cells, clearly if fuel cell vehicles, particularly in I think heavy duty vehicles, the fuel cell costs have to come down. And that's again one of those chicken and egg things. How do you provide the incentives for the new technologies so that the costs come down as we have seen in solar and wind.
Anybody else have a comment that hasn't spoken already? Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
To what Lori said about hydrogen, everything she said has some validity to it. One of the problems with hydrogen is the expense of producing hydrogen. If we can get the cost of hydrogen come down, then it's going to make it a more valuable and viable fuel. As far as the storage is concerned, same thing. It's a matter of finding ways to make it more easily accessible. Companies like BMW have looked at making liquid hydrogen for transportation, which is going to be safer. They can put more in a vehicle at the same time, and it's going to and that will be a big change. So things of that nature will help in that respect. As far as storage, as far as what Rick was saying, one of the things that I've looked at from a cost analysis point of view, and this goes to a value proposition. Everybody looks at lithium ion, but then when you say, okay, and this is one of the reasons, like you said, British Telecom's changing out the batteries, the lithium ion batteries, because you have to look at the length value, the value proposition. And I'm not just talking about from a light crystal point of view. You can look at a flow battery, for instance, where a flow battery is pretty much guaranteed to last 20 years, and the vanadium will still be good after that point. And so therefore that's what makes the value proposition of a flow battery very good. But it's also from an energy point of view versus a lithium ions coming at it from a power point of view. So now we have to look at it saying, okay, what do we really need here? Do we really need power? Or we really need energy. And nobody seems to, we address it, but we really don't address it because everybody's looking at it from a lithium ion point of view and say, well, we need the power. Well, what about long duration type of items where when you say peak shaving or peak demand, when you need 3 or 4 hours, wouldn't it be better to go at it from a battery type of technology that's going to give you a longer duration? It might not give you the power output, but it's going to give you the energy output. These are things that, and as far as Rick's point about, getting utilities, if we make the utilities become part of the solution. And say, hey, we want you to participate. We want you to make money on this. Wouldn't that be a great way to make it go forward? Because I think if they're making money off of it and they see a value proposition, they're not going to stand in the way. They're actually going to get on board and say, hey, we want to help you. We want to make this go forward.
All right. Let's open this up to anybody else who has not yet had a chance to talk. Anybody?
This is Ron Edelstein. I spent 6 years in the solar industry, sold the thermal systems, and 35 years in the natural gas industry. I'm retired now with a small consulting business. So a couple of comments. One, there was an old study by the Institute of Gas Technology, which is now Gas Technology Institute, on putting some hydrogen into the natural gas system. And the numbers are pretty consistent with what the speaker said. IGT indicated that you can put up to 10% hydrogen into the natural gas pipeline system and not have to worry about hydrogen embrittlement. So I want to encourage that. Methane leakage. So studied for a long time. The original Gas Research Institute EPA study came up with numbers 1.5% leakage wellhead to burner tip, including at the home or business. And more recent studies by Gas Technology Institute have reaffirmed that those numbers are 1.4% wellhead to burner tip, even including the latest in natural gas fracturing technology. So those numbers are still consistent, and, you know, there's a lot of alarmist studies out there, and there's a lot of other things, but those numbers have been resilient over time. And the gas industry is doing an incredible job replacing the old cast iron systems, now down to less than 30,000 miles from about 100,000, bare steel, some vintage plastic, and other things. Second point is, with the global warming potential of 23 to 28, the break-even point with coal, I agree with the numbers, are about 8%. And with a leakage of 1.4 to 1.5%, natural gas is still the least global warming potential fossil fuel out there. So I just wanted to make those points.
Okay. Anybody else who has not had a chance to talk yet? Introduce yourself.
This is Michael Walton with Green Spaces in Chattanooga. We're, I guess, looking at a couple things that I haven't heard people mention as much. I mean, we're doing a renovation of an industrial building that has a 33,000 gallon water storage tower that we're looking at using for pump storage, specifically for demand response. So it's not gonna power the whole building, but we can use it for at least a couple hours to generate enough electricity to get a little arbitrage on the solar that we're gonna have on site. As far as I know, and I'm sure multiple people can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think pump storage is still the most efficient form that we've got in terms of technologies. It's just hard to replicate, you know, the sort of larger pump storage facilities, the hydro ones, or the big hydro ones, like Raccoon Mountain and TVA. You know, they have the capacity of, like, two coal-fired power plants. It's just hard to build reservoirs on that are that high throughout the country. Another thing that at least we've heard about, and I would like, if somebody knows more, to comment, capacitors are coming down in price and are getting bigger. And I wonder if there isn't an opportunity for sort of large-scale capacitors to help play a role in this sort of energy future. Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Can I make a comment? Large-scale ultra-capacitors, super-capacitors are definitely moving forward. One technology I looked at, and there's a company out in California called Amber Kinetics. They've actually come up with a flywheel that's being put in a project for 10 megawatts. And that project, their flywheel will give you 4 hours of storage, where a normal flywheel is only going to give you 17 seconds to maybe up to a minute. And that's, it becomes almost a long duration battery, and flywheels will outlast pretty much most battery storage technologies. I'm a big proponent of that. I'd love to see it move forward. I mean, is it expensive? The initial costs are always expensive. As far as pumped hydro, yes, you're correct. That is probably the cheapest way of storage. Looked at cryogenics as storage systems. There's a number of large-scale projects in that respect. So there's different types of technologies out there besides just batteries that are moving forward and have been out there for decades. You know, can I make a quick comment? You know, I went to a show and Jay Leno made a comment. There were five sources of energy for cars in 1908. It was steam, gas, diesel, I forgot the other one, and then there was electric vehicles. So in 1908, we had the possibility of creating electric vehicles. And here we are 100-plus years later, still talking about electric vehicles going forward. Is it efficient? Most definitely. But it's taken us this long to get to that point to realize that, hey, we can do things more efficient than gas. And unfortunately, we're fighting the gas companies and the oil companies, and that's a big uphill battle. So, but yeah, to your point, yes, pumped hydro is a great source of storage if you can, you know, if you have the opportunity to do it.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left, and if one more person wants to comment, that would be the last one for the session here. Anybody else? Somebody new, possibly?
I think everybody left.
No, they didn't leave.
Hey, Sierra, it's Gene. Gene with Microgrid Energy. So I really enjoyed today's discussion. I think it was very valuable. Most interesting to me has been Rick's comments around the different uses of the storage. I agree with a lot that's been said. However, being from the solar industry for so many years, as lithium gets to scale and as those prices continue to drop precipitously, it's just like solar. There was about 100 different technologies. Everybody had a better widget. And then at some point, prices dropped so low that all the other competing technologies were not economically viable. I'm seeing the exact same thing happening in this space. And so I think when you talk about peak shaving and VPPs, lithium ion is going to dominate that for quite some time. And I think when you're talking about curtailment on large solar farms, then maybe some other types of technologies on DC connected, grid systems in front of the meter might take hold, like some of the solid state or flow batteries, or even potentially, creating the gas that could be stored and used in trucks. I'm working on a number of opportunities right now with large trucking firms that are doing short movement trucks that they're completely electrifying their fleet, and I think ultimately the decision on that versus using hydrogen is not out yet. I think at some point that will be, hydrogen might challenge that, but right now lithium seems to be winning the battle on all fronts.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and end it now. Thanks so much, Gene, for the comments. And we'll come back again with an EV, an alternate vehicle type conversation as well at some point. Thanks, everybody, for coming. It was a nice size group, and thanks for the comments. Thanks to the panelists for giving some really good information to get this whole thing started. And look for my emails. Anybody have anything relevant to send that you want to pass on to everybody else, just go ahead and send it to Sierra at mseforum.com. And I'll see you all next time.
Thank you, Sierra.
Thank you, Sierra. Bye-bye,
thanks.
Everybody.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Sierra.
Yes. Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me? I think she's not. She's had, I'll cover it for her, so. I don't know. That seems to me like an agenda. It could actually fill a whole hour, but. I wouldn't mind if you could talk about your work first, because that would help me focus more on what to talk about, you know, when we're introducing Cardi, at least.
just asked where that would be. How would you find that on the website? Okay. All right. I see that. You said you've been doing the work for a long time, and I think you were referring to the Buffalo Commons kind of work, but I may be wrong about that. Could you just talk about a little more about the history of what you were referring to? So some other related questions are, I'm looking at the Cornell and Buffalo High Roads Fellowships thing, and so I've over the years I worked with in Erie County in particular, and then regionally, how does the ILR program interact with the county extension offices? Because my understanding was I used to work a fair amount with the Cooperative Extension Office in Erie County and in some of the other counties, and then it sounded like the Erie County office really kind of lost a lot of capacity. And I haven't really caught up with how things look just sort of institutionally in terms of Cornell's footprint out in that part of the state. So when I said there are, is it fair to say they're pretty well integrated? And I mean, I know in some places the ILR, I used to know a bunch of people that worked in ILR extension too that got laid off. I'm just trying to catch up with is the ILR extension operation or whatever your kind of piece of which I believe, was it Eugene Florin who started it, or So I'm a little familiar with that from a while back. I'm just trying to figure out, are these, like, fully integrated now, or are they kind of working collaboratively, you know? Mm-hmm. And then one other question that's a little related, just kind of like trying to figure out the landscape there, is we used to also, when we were working out there, interact a lot more in the planning side of life with the Center for Regionalism, something like that, that was I think, out of SUNY Buffalo, the Amherst campus. Are they, like, a player in this partnership? Okay, great. Thank you for just kind of helping me catch up there. Does the pause mean it's time for Elizabeth to introduce her work then, or did you have more to say, Kristen? how subtle was that? Can I just ask Elizabeth, even though I know we've talked a lot, the name to Jan, I mean, we've talked mostly in a way about, in our discussion about our mutual interests in engaging policymakers at various levels. The 2Gen program, as I understand it, and as I'm looking at the website again while we're talking too, is very much focused. I mean, the name talks about parents. I assume that means parents and children, from what I see, the idea of 2Gen. Is that right? As opposed to, like, adults and their aging, you know. Anyway, it is about sort of a family system. Is that what it's focused on? Okay, and it's also presumably based in, I actually see it right here, sort of the whole history of Uri Bronfenbrenner's kind of approach to thinking about ecological, socio-ecological kind of system. So I'm just trying to figure out how narrow and tight kind of the focus on the family is, not to use that word or that phrase. Mm-hmm. you. So I'll start a little bit, and I think Elizabeth knows a lot of this already, but Kristen, do you know anything about CAR-T? Should I give a big overview first? Okay, so he is our current tenure track faculty director. He's also kind of got a particularly strong interest in one of the four focus program areas in CAR-T, which is the rural schools program. So if you talk to him about that, I probably don't need to say any more about that aspect of it. But, you know, I will just underscore that one of the important things about it, about the rural schools focus within CAR-T, which is actually run by Gretchen Rimmerchak, she really runs that aspect of things, but one of the important things for us is it does have a presence all over the state. So, there's school districts all over the state that are connected to CAR-T through that. So it kind of complements the other ways we have of reaching out to communities all around the state. It is focused more on rural than on urban, very explicitly, though. We have three other similar programs, which you may or may not be familiar with, and I'll just mention two of them and then dwell a little bit more on the third one. We have the New York State Farm Worker Program, which Mary Jo Dudley runs, which I'm pretty sure is active. I don't know whether it's in Buffalo, but certainly active in Western New York. And do you know about that already? Should I say a word about what it does? Okay, so one of the things that might be significant for this is that it's, since you're an ILR, it is focusing on farm labor. And the fundamental mission is to do applied research, sort of action research kind of approach to working with the farm worker community around the state and providing service and research documentation of kind of what's going on with that community. Obviously, in this particular time in our history, there's a lot of attention in that given to farm labor needs and or the whole issue of workers that don't have full documentation. It is one of our programs. Not all of them do this, but it's one of the programs. Mary Jo every year works with a lot of students, undergraduates, and puts them in the field doing various kinds of projects. So that's kind of like a brief thumbnail of that program. And I should say the four programs I've just mentioned are housed within CAR-T, but they have, they have their own boards. They're pretty independent. We're kind of like a collection of programs as about half of what we do. So, and I'll talk about the other half afterwards. So then the other one is Lead New York. Have you ever heard of that one? So that's a very high-end leadership development program focused on, it's a two-year program. It focuses on recruitment out of the sort of the ag and food system population of the state. And it's Lead New York. There's similar lead programs all over the country in different states. So, leadership training for mostly mid-career kind of level folks. And Larry Vandeval runs that program. Like the farm worker program, Lead New York used to be housed elsewhere, but, some years ago it was brought into CAR-T. So the other one, which I'll spend a little more time talking about, is the Rust to Green program. Is that name at all familiar? So, okay, was Shorna runs the Rust to Green. She's kind of the faculty member in, that takes leadership for the Rust to Green program in Binghamton, New York. The Rust to Green name or brand, if you want to call it that, was actually started by a colleague who was in landscape architecture, who's now emerita, and she started that program in Utica, New York. So I think that, you know, so, and they've, you know, they've collaborated, you know, that there's collaborations going on at sort of the faculty level and to some extent at the program level between the Utica and Binghamton programs. And, you know, the overarching idea there is sort of, again, in somewhat of an action research model to, you know, very long-term intensive engagement with those communities. The Utica program was really focused on, well, because of the landscape architect, it was kind of bringing community development along with design skills into reimagining places and communities in, you know, a Rust Belt city, struggling in many ways. It also, because of the very large refugee resettlement community, there was a lot of attention given to that, working with those communities. And it's still ongoing, although the level of support that CARDI has been able to provide has declined somewhat since Paula Horgan, who's the professor that I was referring to, who started this, she's retired now, so she still works there very intensively. We still have connections there through CARDI, and Paula was actually, you know, in our suite of offices rather than in her office over in landscape architecture. But because she's retired now, we have, I would say, a slightly weakened connection to that piece of it. We have a still very strong connection, however, to through Shorna and another one of our staff people to the Binghamton project in particular. And that the staff person is Heidi Muyoso-Kunzman, who I'll talk more about later. But so the Binghamton project is named Living with Water, as a sort of a Rust to Green subsidiary, if you will, and it's really mostly been paying, you know, it sort of has its thematic orientation to the history of flooding in Binghamton. That's where the Living with Water comes from. So it's, again, it's a, you know, a struggling upstate city, in this case, trying to reimagine a future for itself, through the, you know, through the challenges of where here on campus we might call it climate change, but it, you know, locally I think it's very directly through the history of flooding and what that means for some of the neighborhoods in the community. And it also is, you know, I think one of the innovative things about it is it's very much, both of these are programs have been thinking and working really hard to figure out how to incorporate the creative arts into community development. So in Binghamton, they've used theater, for community-based theater, for example, as one of the ways of engaging with the community. From my perspective, who as someone who, you know, is in, not in a program, so those are the four programs in CARDI. So there are three other staff people, myself, Heidi, who I just mentioned, and Robin Blakely-Armitage, who unfortunately couldn't be with us today. We're kind of like the generalists in CARDI, who we have projects, but we don't have a programmatic focus in the same way that those other four programs do. And our work, you know, the way that I think Robin and I and probably Heidi think about Rust to Green is it's a branded part of what CARDI's broader area of interest are in sustainable communities. So, and we're also called the Community and Regional Development Institute, so almost everything we do is trying to think about, at least conceptually, the relationship between places across the rural-urban spectrum within a region and within regions, and that's also an important theme, I think, within our department as well, which is we're in the Department of Development Sociology, which works globally on development questions. So a lot of, most of our colleagues actually do not work in the United States. But, you know, in a global economy, we think about sort of the importance of connecting sub-state regions and global regions and the forces that are affecting communities and how they respond to them. The thing that connects most to probably Elizabeth's work sort of thematically overall is the idea, one of our kind of working slogans is helping community members make informed decisions about issues of concern to them. And we have a long, so that does not only include elected officials, but we've had a long history of working with elected and appointed local officials in various ways, mostly in support for training of various kinds, like we had various kinds of connections to a number of statewide local government associations, including the New York State Association of Counties, the Association of Towns, the probably our weakest one, although it's there, is actually with the Town, Cities and Towns, the NICOM, Conference of Mayors, statewide association, the New York Planning Federation around land use topics, the Assessors Association, the Clerks Association, that kind of stuff. So each one of those is an individual relationship that has different kinds of strengths and weaknesses on a statewide basis. We connected with Elizabeth, mostly Robin and I connected with Elizabeth around a national, USDA-funded national project that we have that is looking at how could the academy more generally and effectively engage with local policymakers, you know. And this is motivated a lot by the idea of, which I think is from everything I've heard from you, Kristen, is consistent with the idea of what your work is out there, is the idea of just pushing out data and information and sort of a one-way directional push is not the most effective way to work with policymakers. So, but that's kind of the historic model that, whether explicitly or implicitly, still drives a significant amount of how Cornell and other universities conceive of their outreach work. So we're, and what we felt, and one of the reasons we're really excited to connect with Elizabeth is that there, you know, we've been doing stuff like that, as probably you have too, mostly by learning by doing, and that we kind of felt there wasn't a very strong research base under the, to support our work with local policymakers, and we thought, hey, we ought to like create a learning community that around the country that people that are interested in that topic, and try and see if we could collect more of the research that supports what we do and build on that base. So that's one thing. Let's see, what else should I say? I'll just mention quickly that particularly I work more closely with Robin than with other folks in our. Oh, I should also mention we're not hard money funded. So we do have some college funding that comes in, but this is Robin, Heidi, and I. We all hustle for money, which means that we have a little bit of a hard time delivering program over long periods of time. But we're pretty flexible and nimble in being able to respond where we need to, because we're always looking for what are important things to work on, the priority issues to work on, and where the opportunities are. I'm almost done. I know I'm going on a long time. I'll just say a couple other priority areas besides the kind of what we call our informed decision-making project that I just mentioned is rural-urban relationships, the question of sort of transition off of fossil fuels to renewable energy, and climate change topics, and particularly the flooding issue, which is we have a parallel project to the one that Shorin is working on in the Hudson River Valley, looking at flood-related community responses to flooding. There's more, but that's too much already, probably. Just maybe one other thing, because of your emphasis that you all put on kind of the brokerage function that you play. So we kind of view ourselves as a social science networking organization that tries, you know, especially within areas of greatest interest to us, but also more generally, to be aware of particularly of the social science work that's happening on campus, what researchers are doing on campus, and to sort of complement and supplement our partners in the extension system in terms of trying to make connections between faculty on campus and the off-campus community within New York. And just an example of one of the many ways that we try and do that is we have an annual community development institute that is around some theme every year, different theme every year, and it always has researchers, community members, extension people, policymakers as participants. And so trying to foster communications across those kind of categories of people is a big part of how we think of what we try and do. In fall this year, it's going to be, I think, August 3rd to 5th, and it's going to be, so one of, as another example of what we're doing, so we've collaborated a couple times, this will be the second time on a community development institute that we've collaborated with the Water Resources Institute at Cornell, the New York State Water Resources Institute. And one of the things we discovered, we already knew about Chorno's work in Binghamton, but one of the things that we discovered when we and several of our faculty in our department started doing some work on responses to flood risk and climate change in the Hudson River Valley is we discovered that there were about a half a dozen teams of Cornell researchers that were working on flood risk issues in New York State and different parts of the state. So we, for the past year and a half or so, we've been sort of having an informal, every 2 or 3 months, we host let's share your work kind of meeting informally. And then we decided, based on the past year and a half of doing that, that we should build this year's Community Development Institute around the work of the different teams at Cornell that are working on these kinds of issues, including our own, but, you know, also the others, and also going beyond that work, but sort of having the core of work, core of the institute would be around the type of work that people at Cornell are doing in the communities that they're working in, and having our panels and just dialogues are organized around those, that core of work. But you know, a few years ago we did one on you know, family related issues, and we've done some, you know, the themes kind of are all over the map, and they aren't even necessarily on the ones where we and Cardi have strengths, you know, internally. Right. And if you haven't, we also have like two or three kinds of publications that come out regularly featuring mostly, not exclusively, but mostly Cornell work related to that we think is related to sort of the broad community development theme, mostly featuring, as I say, Cornell researchers, but not only. With the goal of hoping, and most of our audience is kind of a policy or policy interested kind of audience around the state. Well, this year, that's what's happening. We've also hosted it in other parts of the state. So, like 5 years and now, like we did one on green infrastructure, which was in, we wanted to bring an Albany policy audience into the mix. So we hosted it not far from Albany. We've done it in different places around the state, depending on the theme and who we're really trying to attract, because we do, as anybody who puts on conferences realizes, it's hard to get people to travel too far. Yeah, I could send you if you just go to our website. I think it's featured. If it's not on the homepage, it would be on the events sort of tab. So I do see a lot of potential, Kristen. We already have ways that we're working on and collaborating with Elizabeth that, we're still exploring, but I do see ways of, a lot of potential for collaborating with you guys and what you're trying to do. At the very least, because, as I say, in our efforts of trying to network, within your region, you sound like you've got a really fantastic networking system already in place that we should know more about and be able to make more connections to. But there's probably other ways. I have a, did you want to respond to that, Elizabeth? I have a couple of questions, a couple of ideas. Okay. So one specific thing is coming out of the presentation that we heard was, you know, I was very impressed with the scope, and I'm sorry, I've been looking for my copies of the material, which I still have from that, but I can't find it right now, so it's not all coming to mind, but, you know, I was impressed with, if you will, particularly by the sustainability theme and the sort of progressive vision that the presenters from Erie County made at that that presentation, because, you know, and it does fit, it fits into a lot of the themes that I think are really important to CARDI. And, you know, I'm not capturing any of the specifics right now, but, you know, I'm particularly interested in the planning side of things, and I know I connected afterwards with the guy from the planning department. So, you know, our problem in CARDI is we're very easily distracted because, you know, because we can go in so many different directions. But, you know, there's no question in my mind that if, you know, if there's a way to keep a conversation going that was sort of trying to look for ways to, that either we ourselves could engage or some of the people that we're working with could get engaged with what you guys are doing out there, that would be almost certainly a possibility to be developed over time. Somewhat related is, you know, CARDI works pretty hard at trying to maintain really strong relationships, as strong as possible, with both the Atkinson Center and Engaged Cornell, who, you know, and what I remember hearing there seemed like a perfect merger of the interests of those two organizations, which have really different missions. You know, so we would like to consider it, we're tiny compared to either of them, but we would like to sort of like, from the perspective, our perspective is more of how do we, you know, whereas Engaged Cornell focuses on the student experience primarily, first and foremost, and the Atkinson Center focuses first and foremost on sustainability research. We like to think of ourselves as like Extension is, and maybe like you are to some extent, as we're kind of, we think of the community's needs first, and then try and figure out how do we kind of create a working partnership that where communities and campus-based people can actually work productively together. So I'll just mention one other thing that I don't really know. So, like, I could also, like, a lot of what I heard was saying, hey, these guys are doing something that we would probably call, or Atkinson Center would probably call sustainable communities, that we brand as Rest to Green. You have, you know, your own way of talking about it, but, like, how should we be sharing, how should we be building a broader campus-based sort of sensibility about this? And, you know, I've always thought that the Atkinson Center, which does have sustainable communities, ought to be taking the lead in this. And maybe they sort of are, but they haven't done it as proactively as I had hoped in the past because of other commitments. But just one thing I wanted to mention is that we've been working with them just in the past few months. They have joined so the Atkinson Center, on behalf of Cornell, has recently decided to join an international network called the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which its goal is to monitor and help accelerate progress towards the Sustainable Development Goals. And think that is going to open some new opportunities for funding and collaboration and work with communities. And I can imagine, given the groundwork that you all have already done out in Western New York, that that might be an interesting place to follow up with this additional resource that I think is going to be available. Right, and this, I should mention that there was just, it's not even official yet, because David Lodge has, I can send you, like, information about SDSN, but it hasn't yet moved to the point of an announcement or anything like that. There's a plan for the New York-based staff from that network to come to campus in fall. And David Lodge is at ACSF, is in charge of arranging all that, or Graham Kerslick maybe is probably actually the person who's in charge of it. But, you know, I don't know who they're going to invite, what kind of meeting they want to have, anything like that. I'm kind of like nudging from the sidelines, which is a lot of what we do at CARDI. Right, and that's a little bit it's a little bit tentative right now, because I think Cornell as an institution is just beginning its explorations of what opportunities does this represent for us. But I think it's a big enough deal that it will be attractive to faculty to sort of organize, and also because the Atkinson Center itself has, one of the reasons it decided to do this is because it's starting to align its priorities a little more around, you may already know this, but it's organizing its kind of work much more than it used to around the idea of rural-urban connections, which is really central to our work here in CARDI, and also to the Sustainable Development Goals, which, to be honest, I didn't know that much about 3 years ago, but I've been learning a lot about them. So. And I'll just send you both, just in case, the SDSN network page. That's actually something that, Elizabeth, I want to talk to you more about specifically, that project, and run some ideas behind you. So I'm wondering if it might make sense to have a follow-up call that, Kristen, you might, I don't know how interested you'd be in it, but you might want to sort of listen into the beginning of it and then drop out if it seemed like it was boring, but. Well, let's put it that way. If there's too high an opportunity cost of your time to to stick to what we're trying to do, but it is, because it would focus on this question of trying to figure out sort of on the ground research strategies for trying to get local policymakers to work with us to understand how they learn about issues. And, you know, our interest in CARDI, we want to do it focused around renewable energy, commercial scale renewables, but I want to, you know, but Elizabeth has like a whole other set of issues. So, and also, oh, yeah. Great. I can support how valuable that might be. We as part of our project on sort of our national project on informed decision making, we had Elizabeth do a webinar for us that I think was fabulous. I will also, just to make it easy, I'll send you the link to the Community Development Institute, you know, page. And I would say, firstly, Elizabeth, maybe you could send me an email about sometimes you might be available to talk, and then and copy Kristen on that. This is again specifically about CARDI's interest in the, just sort of trying to get your advice on it and how to do things. But, Kristen, but the other thing, I think it would be I would love to have a conversation, and this time definitely involving, well, like, Robin and maybe Shorna and Heidi and some other people about the idea, if you think it would be worthwhile, about this kind of idea of sustainable communities in New York State more generally, and what Buffalo represents in that context, or the Buffalo region represents in that context, and whether there's a way to sort of build a stronger Cornell identity and presence around that theme area. And I'd be willing to, you know, I'd be willing to follow your initiative or on that, or to take a little bit of a Cardi initiative just to get a few people to brainstorm about what that might be, depending on your preference. Right, and, you know, I will say that for me, part of the agenda is to try and make it easier for the Atkinson Center to figure out how to step up to the plate around this area, which is one of their six, you know, stated focal areas, but they're very passive. They have been very passive about it, so. So, you know, I think, you know, nobody says other people on campus can't organize meetings. I don't like to think of it as pressure. I like to think of it as opening doors of things that they really want to do anyway, but it makes it easy for them. So just as a bottom line on that, did you want to... What did you want to do next with that idea? Okay. Well, Heidi works on the Rust to Green program in both Utica and Binghamton, so I think it would be... If Shorna's there, she doesn't need to be there, but I think, you know, she's part of Cardi, so one or the other of them should be there, but both of them don't need to be, but they should both be invited. Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Great. Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks.
long-term studies on the effects on your health of, like, giving up carbohydrates.
Those are not going to be my...
Yeah.
You know, like, maybe 3 months we'll do it. I don't believe, fundamentally don't believe that, I have never, let's put it this way, I've never heard of a diet, not that I pay a lot of attention to this, but I've never heard of a diet that succeeded in the long term in the sense that unless you stayed on it rigorously for a long time, which is what people find it hard to do.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that it matters so much what it is as much as that you control what you eat pretty regularly, which is something I'm not normally inclined to do.
Yeah.
I just like to eat. So.
My dad's on this thing, but I guess it's like the difference if it's like a lifestyle change or a temporary thing. But my dad, because he had heart disease, he went on this thing called the Ornish diet, which it's a permanent diet, and it reverses heart disease. Like medicine can't reverse
heart disease. But I mean, what does he do?
It's essentially a vegan diet, and also no added fat, nuts, or seeds, sugar, or avocado and coconut.
So it's the opposite of a low-carb diet.
He can't have, like,
the
sugar like whole grains.
But, I mean, I'm supposed to, on this thing you're supposed to eat, all of this sort of.
Is this one of the ones where you
can
eat like lots of like cheese and bacon? It's not.
No
it's
bacon.
Not the keto genesis.
Oh, it is keto.
Oh,
it's
it is
keto. Yeah.
Oh no.
So most,
not keto. You.
Most of
you.
The stuff I like to eat.
Yeah,
I mean, but I'm also vegetarian. It's the vegetarian.
Okay,
for me.
So that's why no bacon. I know a lot of people who do the keto thing, and they're like, look at this bagel I made.
Right.
The bagel is made out of like. Almonds and cream cheese, and then they eat the bagel with cream cheese and bacon on it, and they're like, look at how healthy I am.
No. I like...
You crazy people eating vegetables.
You know, it's not really that big. The big change for me, because I like nuts, I like avocados, one of my favorite foods in the world. I like tofu, I like tempeh, I mean, most of the stuff that we normally eat anyway. I like vegetables and salads.
Yeah.
I eat a lot of eggs anyway. So the main thing that I find hard about it is no bread.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I really miss.
Yeah. So, I mean, bread is so integral, like some kind of bread or carb in a meal. It's just, I had no idea you were doing that. I just looked at that plate and I thought, that goes with a piece of toast.
Well, what I usually got before I started this, my normal lunch would have been all of this in a wrap.
Okay, yeah.
But to make... Rita happy, I've got the wrap and sauce, which in theory comes with it. So do you, before Scott gets here, I know him quite well, by the way.
We're relaxed.
Right, but is there any, I'll start things off, but do you want me to talk to him? Do you want you to talk to him? Do you just want to kind of go back and forth and
I think we can just have like a pretty casual conversation.
And I only have kind of like at a large scale, I have two kind of agenda, big picture agenda items, and maybe you have some more. One of them is like what he knows about sort of what the county in general is doing with FEMA kind of policies.
He worked on the hazard mitigation.
I'm not 100% sure where, but he's in a position where he would know about it.
Okay.
He's kind of like the natural resource planner. I think he might know about that.
Okay, yeah, because I think I have some questions about the mechanics of that interaction, because counties are required to submit a hazard mitigation plan in order to be eligible for FEMA funding. So just like how that works.
I'm sure he would know something about that. I don't know if he actually personally worked on it intensively, but I'm sure he would know about it. And then, there's the insurance piece and the county's role, and then just the, kind of like what else he knows about what else is going on here and or who else we should talk to. Those are the only kinds of things that I have on, but I'm sure that other things will open up within those broad categories. And Are you going to take, like, good notes?
I think it's good to have a recorder.
Because I can also, I got the recorder. If it's,
I'm on 2 days of inadequate sleep, so I'm not at
Well, I'll record him, too.
Okay. But, yeah, I will take notes. I just know that I'm not feeling very sharp.
You're all over my keto diet without barely a clue you knew what it was.
Oh.
So I'm just saying, you may think you're not sharp, but...
I'm not the sharpest version of me. I guess you're just doing this for your daughter, yeah, because there's this other book that I just actually got from my mom. It's called How Not to Die.
Hey, how you doing? Come on in. This is Sarah.
Hey, Sarah.
Hello. Scott Doyle.
Hey,
Scott. How are you doing? How are you?
Pretty good.
I'm eating there, sorry, I'm catching.
That's all right.
You need some desk?
No, I'm all right.
This, by the way, I don't know if I showed you this. This is John Nolan.
Oh, that's
one of his books.